Wellness to order, and I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2372. And I'm going to call up the folks who have signed to speak. And if anybody, there is a second sheet over there, so if anybody has not signed up yet on this bill and would like to speak, please sign up over there. And I'm going to call Tim Fogener, am I pronouncing that correctly, and Tim Martinez.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
Can I say a word?
You may say one word.
Thank you.
That's it.
Would you like to say any more words?
Yes, I would.
I appreciate being on notice on what kind of a day we're going to have. And I just wanted to say there's so little that a freshman can do, but being Valentine's Day, I wanted to show the love and announce to everyone, if you have cell phones, Blackberries, Raspberries, please don't just turn them to the silent mode. Turn them off. They interfere with Susan's equipment. And if you're testifying, if you wouldn't mind, we have sensitive microphones. Don't get too close. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Representative.
No one's Valentine's got to do anything with that.
He had a need.
Thank you.
That's
well, that
brown
sets the stage.
And happy Valentine's Day to the committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Tressel with Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm pleased to be here to testify today on House Bill 2372. And we appreciate that there's been a lot of employers' concerns taken into consideration on this bill, but there's a couple of other things that we'd like to request the committee consider that would, that would improve it from an employer's perspective and an administrative perspective. One of the things that we'd like you to consider is under the definition of undue hardship to remove financial resources and just have it be based on the size, nature, and structure of the employer's business. I think oftentimes employers are reluctant to turn over their financial books to an agency. And if it was based instead on just the size, structure, and nature of the business, that would be something that could get discussions going. Also,
so could you remind us again what line is those on?
That's on line 9 of page 1. And then the other recommendation we would have is when you get down to the penalty section, which is under section 2 on page 2 of the bill, at least for the initial phase-in period of time, and I understand from previous testimonies on different subjects that the Bureau of Labor and Industries is careful with how they assess penalties. But the thing that came to mind is they also have a mediation unit. And maybe perhaps instead of going into a penalty phase when there's a disagreement about whether or not the employer can accommodate it, it could go to an expedited mediation within BOLI. And again, I think that, ideally you'd want that in there permanently, but at least initially as people are adjusting to the new requirement. And the other thing I just wanted to point out, and I don't know how you would fix it other than to take it out, which I'm sure would not be acceptable, but there's a problem, a practical problem determining, tracking if you're going to use the sick pay and the vacation time in increments of minutes. I think that, and then I'm not sure from the way the bill's written what's the order. They use vacation first or sick leave first and who determines which. But, for example, you have the 30-minute block of time and it may include the 10-minute break. And say it only takes them, they're back at their job in 22 minutes. So then you're actually tracking either 12 minutes of vacation or sick leave, depending. And I'm not sure how most employer systems would track that. So that's just an area that of a practical implementation aspect that I'd just like to raise to your attention. But And the last thing is we met with the proponents, and it's our understanding that based on the way the language is written for, you know, if everybody's working in an office, it's an easier, it's typically easier to find a place. AOI, as you know, has had several breastfeeding mothers there, and we've managed to accommodate them. It's a little bit different in both the manufacturing, which they can typically find something, environment, but non-traditional workplaces, road crews, landscaping, that kind of thing. So it's my understanding, after talking to the proponents, that there's nothing in the bill that would prohibit the employee using their own vehicle as a adequate room. So appreciate the time, and thank you for allowing us to comment.
Thank you, Ms. Dressel. Any questions? Yes, Representative Maurer.
Yes, Madam Chair. Actually, I do have a very specific question about the financial resources piece, and I've thought about this, and a question I have to you, and it may not be as relevant to AOI and your constituency, but the but I look at a school district, for example, because it was testified to us or front of us that it would be reasonable that a school district would allow a teacher time to to express milk in the morning and afternoon, and in that case a school in itself, the size of the school is not necessarily going to inhibit the nature of their business. You know, it's not a there's not an issue there. The structure of the facility is not an issue. But financial resources, when you're talking about hiring a substitute every day for up to a year so that this person can, you know, express milk, is a significant financial hurdle.
Is this a question to this?
It is. I'm asking, in the business community, is there a similar situation? Because I could see where financial resources could be the reason.
Madam Chair and Representative Maurer, just based, and I double-checked again within AOI has a committee of employment practices, and they're typically HR attorneys that represent employers in HR issues. And I was in HR for 22 years prior to coming to AOI. I'm not aware of any time where they've exercised, and I'm sure there are. I'm sure Boley does have cases where some employers come in and try and use the financial undue hardship and turn their books over. But from a business perspective, businesses are reluctant to turn their financial books over to any government agency. And so from a practical standpoint in the private sector, it's at least among our membership, it's rarely used.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Dressel.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Yeah, you'll hear in a few minutes from the Oregon Bankers Association HR Committee Chair, who is herself an HR director at one of Oregon's major banks, a West Coast Bank. As you can see from her testimony, we're not here to oppose the bill. Banks and other financial institutions, generally the frontline staff is young women. So this is a very important issue to us. We do have some suggestions that we would like the committee to consider. Probably the biggest one is if 25 is the right number for a corporation or for business, we're not arguing with that. But what we do think is you ought to readjust that and look at the size of the individual locations. We have numerous, and Jill will talk about that, numerous banks around the state where you have less than 5 people, less than 10 people, less than 15 people in the branch at a time. And I would encourage you, given who I work for, I have accounts at large institutions and small institutions. And I was in Bank of America in Salem the other day, and I counted about 9 people, and that was in the busiest part of the day. So that is an issue we'd like to see addressed. We're not encouraging you or asking you to change the 25. But what we're asking you to think about is further refining that and saying if it's a location with less than 20 or less than 15, whatever the appropriate number is, that that be accommodated. And I think that's our major concern. We also do share the financial resources. People think because banks have money in it that they have lots of money. I would remind you it's generally your money that's in the bank. So that is an issue, too, for us as far as what BOLI will expect branches to do to accommodate this. You will, I think, hear from Jill a little bit today, and I'm happy to provide individual members with additional information about what banks are doing in this area around the state, because there are, especially when you get to rural areas, where, again, you have very small numbers of people in the office, there are some very creative ways that they're dealing with this, because obviously it is a very important issue. So I'd be happy to answer any question. I also do think that we haven't talked about this specifically, but I do think that AOI's comments about how you structure the vacation and sick pay in that small increments, obviously, from business perspective, vacation is to get out of the building and go to Disney World. And sick is, you know, under our laws, if you have a family member or you're sick. So not, again, suggesting we can't work with it, but there needs to be clear on how that process works. Last thing I would say before I turn it over to Jill is we are very interested in making this bill work. We have had Senator Burdick come to our HR committee, and she spent about an hour talking with us about it and going through it, and I think she understands the concerns that we're raising, and we actually have Representative Berger coming to our HR committee today to talk about it from her perspective. So we want to work with the committee. If the chair has any instructions on who we ought to work with on some of these issues, we're happy to do that, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or turn it over to Jill.
Thank you, Mr. Martinez. Any questions? Great.
Madam Chair, you look like you're ready to ask questions. The state has told us that they have a breastfeeding business-friendly program, and that about 50 businesses are in that program. And you indicated in your testimony that actually your business, a lot of your banks are already doing this, but not through the state. Can you further elaborate? Do you have like a percentage? Because I'm assuming this isn't, you know, in every place, but so can you restate that and that you are supporting it currently?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, in fact, I talked to the DHS manager of that program after your first hearing, because I was asking her, you know, was she aware of any banks that had qualified for that? And, you know, I guess from our perspective, is it more important to get this done in the banks and the branches, or is it more important to tell the state we're doing it? Obviously, we believe that it's more important that it be done. We have, to specifically answer your question, we have surveyed our members about what they're doing. Now, I know there's some discussion about whether a restroom is appropriate. In some banks and other financial institutions, you know, you have a teller line. You may not have a break room. That may be the only thing you have is a teller line, an open area, and a restroom. So in those cases, I don't know where else these folks would do it unless, again, you go to the car. And we did hear some examples in Eastern Oregon where that happens. Now, I certainly wouldn't want to do that in December and January when it's frozen over there. But, you know, that's the accommodations that they're doing. We do have, and I'd be happy to share with the committee, and I'll just give you a couple examples. Mothers who need to pump are provided with privacy. Location would vary among our different locations, be it an office or restroom. Not all offices have private offices, and those who do may not have blinds to close for privacy. Others say break rooms, branch manager office, conference rooms. Third one, we have altered one of our women's bathroom stalls, put in a chair, an electric outlet, and table. So, you know, we are doing these things currently, and we just want to make sure that this law, potential law, doesn't, you know, make it more difficult for us to do what we're already in place, have in place.
Thank you, Mr. Martinez. Any further questions? Thank you.
My turn. A little
yes.
Nervous. Good morning, Chair Tomei and distinguished members of the Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee. I'm here to provide testimony, as Tim mentioned, on House Bill 2372 related to breastfeeding in the workplace. I'm Jill Fonder, and I'm Senior Vice President and Human Resource Manager for West Coast Bank. We're an Oregon-based commercial bank with 47 business locations and 667 employees. I have the pleasure also of working with the Oregon Bankers Association. I am the chair of that committee for Human Resources this year, and in that role, I am pleased to provide feedback on prospective and existing legislation. We, as Tim mentioned, do not oppose any additional changes to the breastfeeding bill. We would just like to have some consideration, additional consideration. West Coast Bank is proud to have been selected one of Oregon's 100 best employers for the past 3 years, and in fact, 15% of the members that make that 100 best list are financial institutions in the state of Oregon. We are an organization and a business group that has historically had high numbers of female employees. In fact, at West Coast Bank, 72% of our employees are female. And so for work-life issues, that's very important. I was a working lactating mother, and so I can speak from real experience. I nursed 3 children and 1 set of twins. And so I have some experience in that regard. We understand that breast milk is very important to infant health. We would, however, propose that the committee consider adopting an alternate method for establishing the threshold of who would be eligible. And what we would recommend is that we look at an individual location and how many employees are at that location versus how many employees are the total company numbers. And what we would recommend is that we look at 15 or more employees per individual business location instead of 25 total employees. It is an undue hardship on a very small bank branch to try to have to add additional break time and to try to find a private space. We're very creative in that, and we do that because we care about our employees. What we are asking is that the language in the initial bill be modified to say that if no other space is available at the business location, then the public restroom can be considered a reasonable accommodation. When we look at our restrooms, that's probably the most often cleaned location in the whole building, cleaned with solvents and whatnot every day. Banks traditionally have had small branches scattered throughout their market areas, which is several larger branches. At West Coast Bank, 36 of our locations have 10 or less employees. That represents 76.5% of our total locations. According to the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, the number of bank branches in Oregon as of June 30th was 1,071. So it's a significant number of business locations that would be impacted by the 25 or more rule. Making physical building modifications at a small branch is very costly, and in many cases we already have an ADA accessible restroom where we can bring a chair, a table, outlets. We would also like to consider, and reiterate what Tim and my colleague has said, the additional rest periods is really a difficult situation for a very small branch with 5 or less individuals, and we would like to have that considered. Our experience with lactating mothers is that ours have not needed additional time, that their rest periods that are provided for statutory purposes and their lunch break have been sufficient amount of time. Again, as a lactating mother of 3, I was able to do that and work my normal schedule and use my break periods and my lunch periods. I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and would be happy to answer any questions on behalf of either West Coast Bank or the Oregon Bankers Association's HR Committee.
Thank you so much. Yes, Representative.
Madam Chair. Jill, thanks for sharing today. So let's see if I can try to capture this. You're trying to set 2 different standards, 15 and 25?
Nope.
Or are you just wanting strictly, you're recommending to do 15?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, if I may, what we're saying is the underlying bill would have, if you're a company of 25 or more, you would fall under the legislation. But then there would be a further section that says if at one of your locations, one or more of your locations, you have less than, Joe mentioned, 15 employees, then you would either be exempt from the act or there would be another scheme that we would develop in consultation with the proponents.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Okay. So, all right, that's where I was trying to go with this. So what you're trying to do then is kind of almost somewhat of, well, from my past experience, a work site definition.
That's correct.
Okay.
Any further questions of this, either any of these witnesses? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Catherine Bradley, let's see, is this, okay, Catherine Bradley, J.L. Wilson, and Dina. Dina, good. Oh, Dina. Yeah, wonderful. Good Mohab. Good Mojab. Mojab. JL, did you want to come up? I called you. Didn't you want to speak? You're on the list.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Bradley, and I'm an administrator for the Office of Family Health at the Oregon Public Health Division, Department of Health Services. You have in front of you a copy of my testimony, a copy of some supplemental information, and then you also have a copy of our booklet on the Breastfeeding Mother-Friendly Employer Project. You've heard quite a bit of testimony, so I'm not going to go over the other points of my testimony that I think have been repeated, but I do want to hit a couple of key components. Over 89% of Oregon women start out breastfeeding, and as you now know, that's the highest rate in the nation and something that Oregon is distinctively known for. The fact that less than 27% of Oregon infants are exclusively breastfeeding at 6 months is really the crux of this issue and what this bill is intended to address. We think we've got very strong evidence that Oregon women want to be able to breastfeed, and the challenge of what happens within the workplace is the predominant issue that's trying to be explored. We are very pleased that we have a 7-year history of having a breastfeeding mother-friendly employer project, but I think it is significant to note that this voluntary effort has largely been supported in a fairly limited way. We have 54 Oregon companies that currently are on our list, and I think you have a list of those companies within the brochure that you have. We've had large discussions with a number of employers, and their preferences indicated that while they do create environments within their settings, they really don't want to have to do a standardized policy. They want to be able to be flexible and to be accommodating. We think it's critically important that for Oregon to be able to talk about the 6-month period, the drop down to 27% of women that are actually able to continue to breastfeed really is a reflection of individual workplace application. We also think it's important that this standardization and this understanding of best practice, while it is growing, is still a cultural shift. You'll notice the majority of employers that are listed on that list are healthcare or governmental environments. So again, we are still dealing with an important issue of educating and helping employers understand it's a significant advantage for the mother, for the employer. It increases productivity for the workplace. It decreases health care costs. But we're still in the midst of that gradual shift. So we do think that this really is a critical piece of legislation. The voluntary compliance has not been overly successful. We'd love to be able to tell you that the majority of employers do fit in this category. But in fact, currently, less than 4% of Oregon businesses have a designation of a breastfeeding mother-friendly employer. And that's a very significant number when you think across all of Oregon. The DHS Public Health Division and the Office of Family Health staff and I are available to answer any questions and provide any additional information to this group that you would find helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Maurer?
Yeah. Dr. Bradley, question about the prevalence of breastfeeding. And my understanding is that, in fact, in the last couple of years, it's decreased. Is the number of women that are choosing to breastfeed is actually in a slight decline?
Representative Tomei and Representative Maurer, in fact, Oregon's numbers are the highest in the nation, and our numbers have increased. If I can give an anecdotal story, one of the members in our office actually was talking about the fact that she's currently pregnant, ready to deliver in about a month, and the difference between this experience and what she had had with her previous child 4 years ago. Once one visits an OBGYN, one usually is on, it seems like, every mailing list in the country for information and education. And 4 or 5 years ago, when she had her previous child, breastfeeding information was part of the information that came across as a choice. What she's really noticed significantly has been in the information that comes across into her doorstep and through the mail is that breastfeeding now is clearly identified as the right thing to do. And the real push of an understanding that breastfeeding is a necessary requirement, she says it's actually getting pretty uncomfortable, and she wonders how other mothers will accommodate, because the understanding is to be a good mother, you need to be a breastfeeding mother. Our rates are increasing in Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions?
I have, I guess, a little bit of a concern, Dr. Bradley, the mechanism that's been placed with this House bill. And what it is that where, from the testimony I've heard so far, I like your department, your division.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to be more sensitive to understanding what the whole issue is here. And... I can say that from, you got to develop this first, I'm sure. I mean, I say this from the perspective of having three daughters and my oldest one just having giving me a grandson here a couple months ago, so you know, I'm sensitive to that part. But, you know, the mechanism for enforcement and overview of it right now in the statute or in the bill rests with the Department of Bureau of Labor Industries Bowling. I see a better fit coming from your shop. Be truthful with you because of your knowledge and understanding, especially giving us the information of back in 1998 when you implemented, you know, that whole employer project. I'm curious your thoughts.
Representative Tomei and Representative Olson appreciate the consideration. Public health educates. We don't enforce. And that really is, I think, the gift that we bring in terms of our partnership with our state programs. For example, right now we've got a great project going on with the TANF Jobs Program and a partnership with our office. And, you know, their interest in working with their subcontractors and recognizing that their subcontractors didn't necessarily have a breastfeeding-friendly environment, and yet they were working in with training and educating women that they were also trying to sort of move back into the workforce. And we put together a terrific project with them, and we provide the educational materials, and that's really what our strength is. Our strength is not in enforcement, and that's why we think that actually the correct location with Bowley really does work well, because they have more of an enforcement arm, and we have the education arm, and that partnership we really believe is the right kind of a partnership that brings both strengths of the side of the governmental components that will best suit the industries.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
I think you do have an enforcement arm, you know, in public health. During quarantining, and there's laws that Oregon addresses in quarantine issues, and so I would just suggest that public health does, in fact, have an enforcement arm to it.
Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, without getting too deep into another opportunity you have at a different committee, our public health laws of enforcement are actually quite limited. And in this case, if we were looking at trying to put expectations on employers, it probably would require statute changes and law changes and additional financing considerations that we're not designed for. Currently, right now, we have one half-time FTE in our WIC program, and then over 40 committed WIC staff advocates at the state level, and another 350 at the local level, through which a lot of this extension really occurs. So it's advocacy through programs. But in reality, we have a half-time person that is dedicated to driving this. So, you know, again, I think Bowley has the resources, the accommodations, and the financial structure for this that public health complements very well. But it would be a pretty significant shift and a lot of cost for the state to make that kind of transition, as well as legal implications for our state statutes.
Thank you. We have a nexus. Oh, I Children are hard to follow. JL, I was going to let you go first, but I think she's been sitting here so well that I think we need to let her speak first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Donal Gunmojab. For the record, I live in Hillsborough. There are two reasons why I support House Bill 2372. The first reason is that when I grow up, I don't want to have my ability to breastfeed undermined at my place of work. The second reason is that I don't want mothers of the present and the future to have difficulty getting their employers to understand their need for breastfeeding support and getting their employers to take action to meet it. It is not enough for me and the other people who testified last week and today to support this bill. We need your support as well, and I strongly encourage you to give your support on House Bill 2372. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify before you today. I hope that after listening to and reading the testimony of the people who support this bill, you will support it too. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Before I invite questions, I want to say to the committee and to the audience that someday you will say, I knew her when. Any questions for this lovely young lady? Thank you so much for your testimony.
You.
We really appreciate it.
JL, that's a tough act to follow.
That's okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We're JL Wilson representing NFIB. We're very interested in coming together on a bill that everyone can support. And I wanted to just share with you our concerns and ask for your consideration of them. We did not consult with AOI, but actually our points are much the same. When you talk about subjective terms, such as on lines 6, 7, 8, and 9 of the bill, things like reasonable effort, undue hardship, significant difficulty. Those are subjective terms that, in fact, very reasonable people can disagree over. The problem obviously stems from the fact that you're asking BOLI to come in and enforce what could be disagreement between reasonable folks. And so our suggestion on the bill and something that would draw us in would be, Ms. Trussell from AOI suggested expedited mediation. That is sufficient. Something along the lines that I was thinking of was perhaps something in statute that allows for a time frame, say 30 to 60 days, where there's a consultation that leads to compliance, that sort of thing, as opposed to just outright enforcement and penalty. And I think something along those lines where you nudge employers along or perhaps get them to see the wisdom in complying is much better than a system in which people can disagree, reasonable people can disagree over subjective terms and then have immediate enforcement. And I would prefer to see something along the lines of a consultation prior to enforcement. We're also not excited about the inclusion of financial resources on line 9 of the bill. Quite frankly, and Ms. Trussell hit the nail on the head, our folks are not exactly excited about sharing their books with most agencies, particularly BOLI. And so we would ask for your consideration on that language as well.
Thank you, Mr. I'm going to ask a question. So what do you mean by consultation? How would that work if a pregnant woman has a child and she's coming back to work and or maybe she hasn't missed any work, and she's wanting to breastfeed after a child is born? So what would that consultation be?
Thank you, Chair Tomei and members. You know, I think that there is a fairly good example with Oregon OSHA, where Oregon OSHA, if you want, they have a consultation unit that, inspects the work site, looks for violations, and then they're an employer. It has an obligation to fix those problems because there very well could be an inspection. And that's the model that Oregon OSHA has. I would envision something, it doesn't have to be similar, but the concept is similar. Whereas if there is a disagreement, BOLI would have the ability to consult with the employer and give them, it can be a short time frame, but at least a time frame in order to comply before the hammer of enforcement comes down.
You understand that the 30, 60 days would just be an impossible situation for a lactating mother.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I'm not married to the number of days. What I'm advocating for is a concept that requires at least a minimal amount of consultation prior to just outright enforcement. Like I said, I'm not married to 30 or 60 days. It was just the time frame that I chose.
Thank you, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My questions were along the same line. That if there was a time frame, it's hard for me to imagine how with other enforcement issues on an employer work site, there might be time frames that are legal. In the case of a breastfeeding mother, there's a time frame that's biological, and putting off that ability for that woman to express milk could very quickly lead to a very real reduction in the supply of milk for the child who is waiting. So for that individual employee who's requesting the mediation, even a delay of a couple of weeks could really hamper that woman's ability to continue nursing her child. So I'm wondering what suggestions you might have that would meet your objectives, but also would meet the objectives of this bill, which is to allow women to continue to provide nutrition to their children without risking diminishing that supply because of external time constraints.
Thank you, Representative Tomei and Representative Gelser. Your point's well taken. I'm not married to 30 or 60 days. I'm just saying that there should be at least some time frame so that there's voluntary compliance, as opposed to bully coming down with the hammer of enforcement on something that would be, this is new to employers. I think we all understand that this is a new requirement placing on employers, and you're talking about subjective terms, what constitutes undue hardship on an employer, and reasonable people can disagree over those terms. And so what I'm suggesting is it may be a very short time frame in which Boley can mediate, but I would hope that the committee would see wisdom in at least granting a small time frame to having employers become compliant.
Gelser, you were through?
I'm through, thank you.
Thank
you, Madam Chair. I was referring back, I missed last week's testimony from Boley, but in their testimony they mentioned that they would emphasize compliance through training and education and anticipate few penalty assessments only being assessed if willfully failing to implement this. Has NFIB members had a poor relationship with Boley that somehow they don't believe this would be the course of action they would take?
Thank you, Chair Tomei and Representative Kotek. It would be a leap of faith. To be quite honest, it would be a leap of faith to suggest, well, you kick it over to the rulemaking process and everything will work out. I personally, and I think most folks who represent business would like to see some guidepost and statute so that they have some reasonable assurance that there is at least a minimal time frame in order for compliance once Boley has been brought into the situation. Chair Tomei and Representative Kotek, you ask if there's a poor relationship or some reason. That's not unique to Boley. It is the relationship between business and government. There, we would like to have some minimal assurance. So I don't want to say that this is unique to Boley. It certainly is not.
Thank you.
Representative
Maurer,
do you have questions?
Yes, Madam Chair, I guess I have, and the mediation issue seems to me to be problematic, and because businesses or anybody, there's a due process requirement, and if you stop breastfeeding in a matter of a day, 2 days, then it's the window may be closed, and so that I'm not sure how governments can be able to move in a period of 48 hours when there is an issue. So I would ask you a question specifically about the employees. Line 12 says the employee shall notify the employer that the employee intends to express milk upon returning to work. And it seems to me more logical to run these issues prior to the birth of the child and the employee returning to work. Would you be more amenable to looking at the window before the child is born? Because there is a due process, in my opinion, issue. You can't just throw the hammer down. And I think maybe those issues would be worked before. And so what would be a reasonable window before to say we need your notification early instead of at the point of complaint.
Thank you. Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, you make an outstanding point, and I think that obviously it would be much more preferable to resolve these issues before, and as you point out in on the second page of the bill, what you allude to, you know, a 60, 90-day time frame prior to the birth of the child, something where those issues can be ironed out and not... you know, bring Bowley into the mix, or if you do bring Bowley into the mix, that you can do it before the child is born. I think that's just a much better way of going about things.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Is it okay to, if you're listening to Mr. Wilson and he makes you think of something for Dr. Bradley, to go back to Dr. Bradley?
Okay.
The vice chair said okay.
Yeah. I'll do push-ups afterwards.
So I just wanted to go back to this point you made about you're primarily interested in education and you're not for enforcement. You're not set up for enforcement, and you gave some good reasons. But I wanted to ask you from a carrot and stick standpoint, which we've sort of alluded to, would you not reconsider the possibility that the progress that you've made, that you've testified to, positive progress, albeit small, constitutes some momentum and a positive relationship with business? And I would parenthetically say I'm very impressed by AOL and our friends from the banking community showing their attitude and willing to comply. So with that momentum, isn't it worth reconsidering the possibility that you would actually be the right agency because you're not known as the enforcer? And if you had some more resources, you could do a lot more with the carrot than the stick. Is that too convoluted of a question?
Chair Tomei and Representative Gilliam, I would be loath to turn down any possibility for new resources. but in all honesty, I do think there is a balance in governance, in state governance, and I think there's an important role for enforcement. We have worked a lot across a number of different industries trying to find ways of, for example, trying to, we offered AOI the opportunity to post a web link on their website to do mailings to their members. None of those have quite caught up at this point in time. One of the most effective interventions we actually had occurred about 2 months ago when Dr. Bruce Goldberg, on a visit to the Department of Employment, asked about what they were doing about educating employers about breastfeeding-friendly employer project activities. Within 24 hours, my office had 4 phone calls. We had a staff person over at the Department of Employment identified for this project, and we have a great collaboration going on with a lot of information that's getting ready to get distributed across Oregon. But to me, that's the example of the individual. And the struggle we've got right now is we've got examples of individuals, individual managers who get it and really are working hard, individual employers who get it and are working hard. But after 7 years, we've got a 27% penetration rate after 6 months. And I'd like us in 5 years to be able to come back to this committee to say Oregon not only leads the nation in initiating breastfeeding, but also with 6 months exclusive breastfeeding. And I honestly think that best intent and individual employers is not going to get us there, that it really does require a larger activity. And I don't feel that public health is the place for being able to do that enforcement. I think that complicates our mission, and our mission really is to look at health and education and protection across communities. And we do that best within our role that does not really require enforcement, particularly, I think, in this venue. But thank you for your question.
Thank you so much. We have, if you don't mind, we will have further hearings, and I think we can beat this one to death. And I'd like to move on with other people who are here to testify, and we'll have further information.
I have notes. I can bring it up later.
Pardon?
I have notes. I can bring it up later.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you very much. And we'll call up Jim Green. I'm going to bring him up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association. I apologize about missing the hearing last week. I had a death in my family and had to deal with arrangements for that. First and most importantly, I want to get on the record, primarily because my wife is probably listening at home, that we do not oppose this bill. We support the policy behind it. My wife was breastfeeding both of our children, so we support the policy, but I believe that the bill as it's currently drafted, and I spoke with the chair and two of the sponsors this morning before the hearing, that the bill has some unintended consequences as it relates to what goes on in school districts. As you know, school districts are part of public employers, and we're covered by the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act. And as the bill is currently written, whether we would have unpaid rest periods or not, and school districts across the state are actually providing this, and they are providing places for mothers to express milk. But as the bill is currently written, it would become a mandatory subject of collective bargaining. And for those of you that have been on a school board, and I think two of the members on this committee have been on a school board, collective bargaining is an arena where we talk about pay, benefits, and other things. And in speaking with one of the sponsors, that's not what the intention of this bill is, to bring this into the collective bargaining arena. If you take a look on page 1, line 16 of the bill, unless otherwise agreed to by employer and employee, the employer shall provide the employee a 30-minute rest period. That's what's going on in school districts right now at the building level. Building level principals or supervisors are working with their employees to provide time for this to occur. As the bill is currently written, however, it would become part of the collective bargaining process. And as an association, we have traditionally opposed bringing in other issues under mandatory collective bargaining law. There's an easy fix for that. ORS Chapter 243, which is our Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act in this law, has issues for school districts that are exclusively not part of collective bargaining. And I spoke with Representative Berger and Representative Rosenbaum and you, Madam Chair, this morning that I'd like to work with OEA, the Oregon Education Association, to ensure there's no other unintended consequences with an amendment so that we could exclude this from mandatory collective bargaining. I think this type of process works best at the local level, where building level principals or supervisors work with their employees to get this worked out so that there is time provided for employees to do this. But to bring it to the collective bargaining arena is not the way this process should work. This is a local solution that's done building by building, depending on the circumstances. I think, Representative Maurer, you brought up the issue of having to provide substitute teachers. That's a local issue that needs to be dealt with building by building. And as I read the information that came from the previous witness from DHS, and it talked about employers having policies, I think school districts should probably have policies where they've worked with their employees to create policies on their books about what they're going to do with mothers who need to express breast milk and work on it locally. But to bring this, and I believe it's an unintended consequence of the bill, when I spoke with the sponsors, they didn't mean it to be under a mandatory subject of bargaining. But unfortunately, when you write a bill, sometimes you don't know other areas of the statute. And we'd like to work to get an amendment to make sure that it's not a subject of collective bargaining. Again, I'd like to work with OEA on that process. But I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Jim. Representative Protest. Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you provide specific reason why this particular topic, which is a public health issue, should not be a mandatory subject of collective bargaining?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, because the process, as I said, should be more at the local building level, because each building is a little different. And I can take the example of my school district. I'm a parent here in the Sam Kaiser School District, and I'm not saying that health issues shouldn't be a part of collective bargaining, but these are issues that are dealt with best at the building level rather than at the district level, because I can think of a small school building here in the Sam Kaiser District that's an elementary school, that's a very old building, that has about 12 employees, and it could be an undue hardship for them. But they've worked out or will work out a process for this to occur, as opposed to the school board bargaining team and the teachers union bargaining team arguing at the district-wide level over what ought to be provided or not provided. We have processes at the local level, at the building level, where we work with employees with regard to this. I don't believe the collective bargaining arena is the best arena for this to occur. I think the best arena for this to occur, again, is at the local building level. And we'd be supportive of an amendment to this bill that would say school districts shall adopt policies that have that occur. We don't have a problem with that. But throwing it into the collective bargaining arena, where we're talking about money, health insurance, vacation, non-contact time, with regard to students, I don't think is the best arena for this to occur.
Follow up. I'll just be clear. I disagree this personally because I do think it's a public health issue and I think it's important. My understanding of collective bargaining is, yes, things get bargained at the district level, but often there's local site implementation. And I do think also if you don't conclude in collective bargaining, sometimes things don't get done. And this is a resource issue and it's an important issue. And so I understand your concern. I do think it's an important issue and deserves that kind of placement in collective bargaining.
And Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I'd be happy to have an offline conversation with you about the collective bargaining process and why this one probably wouldn't work at the collective bargaining level. But as I said, we'd be happy to say school districts shall adopt policies with regard to this and work at the local level. That's what school boards are policy-making entities. And to have this at the collective bargaining level, while we do have district level, we hope we don't have local implementation of those collective bargaining agreements, because if you have one building doing one thing and one building doing another, that's where we get unfair labor practices filed against our school districts, and we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars across the state fighting unfair labor practices. That's why we'd like the local flexibility, which I think is built into the bill at line 16 on page 1, where you have employees and employers hopefully working it out as opposed to some sort of policy that may not work district-wide.
Thank you. Follow-up? Did you have follow-up? Okay, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Chair Tenney. If an item like this was part of a collective bargaining agreement, is there the potential that if it didn't rise to the top of the priority list for either of the bargaining units, either the management or the unit, given the membership of the unit or the priorities in that bargaining cycle, would this be at risk of not floating up and being protected in that agreement?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, you know from serving on a school board, and I don't know if you were on the local bargaining team at the Corvallis School District, if it's a mandatory subject, you must discuss it. And I think rising it to that level, again, doesn't serve the interest of the bill and the spirit of the bill, where you want to try to have it worked out at the local building level. And I believe what you probably want in the bill, as I said before, is having school districts adopt policies and that they speak with their employees. I mean, we adopt policies all the time. One of the ones that we had to adopt under federal law dealt with non-nutritional foods, and we had to put together groups at the community level to come together to help school districts develop that type of policy. That's what I envision here. I believe that's a type of process that works better than the collective bargaining process, because it can get drawn out. I mean, while it may be talked about, other things get thrown into the collective bargaining agreement. And I don't think that's one of the issues you want to have brought into the collective bargaining agreement.
Can I follow up? But what you are saying is you would be comfortable with putting in statute directing all school districts to have in policy the accomplishment of this idea, and then it would be non-negotiable in terms of it could never be taken away. It would have to be there. So it would come up in the bargaining process or the budgeting process, and that if it's in the policy, the school district must be implementing that and making it take place at every site.
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, that's what I'm suggesting. You know from being on a school board that the policy level, when a board discusses a policy and wants to implement a policy, they generally don't do that in a vacuum. They tend to work with their staff, and on this issue, I believe that in the school districts that have those folks, the HR director would want to work with folks to make sure this would work. Again, I think the policy level of school district is where you want this to be implemented. And we don't have a problem with saying to school districts, adopt a policy on this issue, working with your employees.
Representative Gelser? Gilliam, I'm sorry. Jeez. No, this is for you.
Sorry.
Valentine's Day.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I haven't been on a school board, but I don't understand how this wouldn't, your idea of exempting, wouldn't undermine the integrity of this bill if we went forward. I mean, I just don't know how we could say that and then not say to AOI, look, you know your businesses, just have them work it out at the local level, or to NFIB. Maybe I'm missing a point, but to pull this out seems to just gut the bill in terms of its integrity.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I'm not suggesting gut the bill. What I'm suggesting is require school districts to adopt a policy on this issue. Have them adopt a written policy on this issue. We do that throughout the statutes. If you take a look at the education code in this state, school district boards must adopt policies on a variety of issues. And if they adopt a policy on this, I think what you say in this bill is you leave the language of the bill, but then you add a different section of the bill saying, and school district shall adopt a policy implementing this statute.
Can I follow up, Madam Chair?
Follow up?
But you're aware that the bill is not asking employers to adopt a policy. It's telling employers, this is what you'll do.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I understand that. My concern is, as the bill's currently written, it's a mandatory subject of collective bargaining. I think to get it out of that arena requires school districts to adopt a policy to implement the law. And again, we're not opposed to the policy issue here. We understand the health benefits of breastfeeding. We understand the health benefits and what it means to a mother and a family. And we're not disagreeing with that. What we're disagreeing with is that it's a mandatory subject of collective bargaining. And I understand the intention of the law. We don't want to gut the intention of the law. I think it actually makes it stronger for school districts to say, even for school districts with less than 25 employees, you'll have a policy on it. And you'll let your employees know what that policy is. And your policy shall include the following things. If you take a look at the education code in this state, that's what school district boards do. And that's how you get things implemented at the local school district level. Because if you pass a law, I can tell you that of our 197 school districts, the ones that really focus on issues related to this will deal with these issues. But if you say in there that they also have to implement a policy, then all 197 school districts will take this up and discuss this issue.
Representative Gelsert, what I would like to do is put a work group together, maybe with Representative Gelsert and Representative Kotek, to work with this
Madam
gentleman.
Chair.
Yes.
Me. I think what you need to do is you need to invite one of us guys rather than have. I'm sorry, but I do think that it would be good to have
okay.
that perspective.
All right. Representative Gilliam, would you like to be on a work group to
if
work on this issue?
Note.
Hmm?
If you'll send me a note.
Jeez Louise.
Representative Gelsert.
Thank you. I'm looking for a little bit of clarification. I want to start out with I absolutely support this bill, and I want to make sure that this happens in all workplaces, including schools. I think what your issue triggered for me were some experiences that I had as a school board member and seeing the difference between different buildings, elementary school, middle school, high school. And the one that's coming to mind for me, too, it's the scheduling of, this gets to my point, I promise, the scheduling of parent-teacher conferences and the schedule of break times during the school day. And the difficulty about doing that in our bargaining is that it becomes uniform across the school district, so that we have in our school district break times that don't work for our teachers at the middle school because their needs for break time are different than at the elementary school, which creates problems with supervision, and it creates some very unhappy teachers whose needs aren't met because of that give and take at the collective bargaining table. And the same thing happens, the difference between high school and elementary schools, with when conferences are set. So my concern when you raise that is whether or not, if this was bargained at the collective bargaining table, if it might not end up with an agreement that actually hampered some women's ability to express milk depending on the level of grade that they taught at. And so that's the concern that I had. And what I wanted to follow up on again was Representative Gilliam's question. My understanding is that if the statute included the direction to school districts that they must adopt a policy for implementation of the law, ensuring that every woman in their district that was expressing milk was supported to do that with appropriate facilities and work breaks, that would accomplish the same thing without in a governmental bargaining contract actually unintentionally creating a hardship for women that are teaching at different grade levels because those scheduling needs are different. Am I on the...
Madam Chair, Representative Gelsert, that's exactly what I'm talking about. You do have different levels between your elementary schools, your middle schools, and your high schools, and the break times that they have, and the non-duty, non-contact time that they have. And to leave it to the collective bargaining level, you're exactly right. You can have some unhappy teachers at the elementary level because you're more focused on the middle school or the high school level kids. I think what you want to do is require school districts to adopt a policy, because at that level, then they can say, our elementary school policy for this is this. Our middle school policy for this purpose is this. Our high school. And it works more individually, campus by campus and building by building. I don't want to get around the intent of the law. I believe it's important. But putting it under the mandatory collective bargaining law, you've stated my point probably better than I did before this committee.
Question from Sense. Okay.
And this is more of a question to staff for the work group, but it's not clear to me why the undue hardship out, more or less, in the bill would not also apply to the public employers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this isn't a fait accompli that you, in collective bargaining, have to somehow ignore the undue hardship or reasonable effort part. So I'm getting back to Representative Gilliam's comment. We should have some equality here. If we're asking the private employers to do this, special accommodations public might not seem very fair. So we get clarification on how the undue hardship part would apply.
And Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, we're not trying to get differential treatment. We have differential laws that cover us in our collective bargaining law. And I believe, you know, I think you heard testimony from Ms. Trussell and Mr. Wilson, and I forget the lady's name from West Coast Bank right now, but they talked about how reasonable minds may be able to differ on undue hardship and reasonable efforts. That's what local districts do when they put together a policy group, is try to define those terms as it relates to their community and their school district. And I'm not trying to get out from underneath that requirement. I think those are the terms that need to be defined for each local school district on what they're going to do with regard to this. Again, we support the policy. We believe it's important. But we believe that it needs to occur at a local level rather than at a collective bargaining level where we're dealing with the employee representative on salaries and benefits.
And what I would like to do at this point is to send Representative Gilliam, Representative Kotek, and Representative Gelser on a work group to work with you to come up with some language and an amendment that would work for everybody.
And Madam Chair, again, I'd like to work also with the Oregon Education Association. I believe Beth Ann Darby handles these issues for OEA, and I haven't had the opportunity to mention her, but I will as soon as
Great.
I see her.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, Madam Chair, did you want to keep the work group to legislators only, or can we add someone who is a proponent of the bill to who's been
working? Let's discuss that
okay,
after.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see. Somebody else seemed to indicate. All right. Do we need Bowley now, do you think? Okay.
You don't have to work at
this. Okay. No. All right. Diane Garrett. Cynthia Good, is it Mojab?
Mojab.
Thank you. And Lori Meter. Oh, we've got a big group.
She could wait no more.
Get to
these three.
Lori,
what's
her name?
Amelia.
Amelia. Smythe?
I called Elizabeth.
Diane, do you want to wait a minute?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
There should be three.
I think we've got three here.
She's going to not be available as a resource today. She doesn't have last time.
She's
not
going
right now.
She's not?
She's going to be available if you have questions.
Oh, I see. Okay. Thank you, ladies. Thank you for waiting. Go in any order that you would like.
Good morning. At the outset, please forgive me. I'm fighting off a pretty nasty cold, but I am pleased to be able to be here. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Schwartz. I'm a partner at the Portland office of Perkins Coie, which is a law firm. I have been a nursing mother, and I am here to simply provide some perspective from the business side of this equation about how our firm has dealt with nursing mothers and the ease with which it has been able to accommodate their needs and without any noticeable drop in productivity. When I was pregnant with my first child and came back, I needed a facility because my office had a glass window that ran down the length of the door that prevented complete privacy. And so I got a closet. But that was fine. It had a table, it had a chair, and an outlet, and that was all that I needed. It didn't require any additional space. It didn't require a devoted space. It was just a nook that I could go into and meet the needs that I needed to have met. When I was pregnant with my second child, the firm actually moved into a new building, and in the course of the design, designated a space which is used solely for the purpose of expressing milk, purchased a refrigerator, which was the only capital outlay that was made, and then used existing couches and lamps and a telephone to put in that room. Since that time, which was 2003, there have been four nursing mothers who have used the facility at the firm, most of whom, if not all, I think, have been able to work while they were in the room, whether by making telephone calls or reading other documents that they needed to get done as part of their workday. Those women had fewer days than they had to be out of the office because their children were not as ill because they were getting the benefits of having breast milk. We applied for the DHS Breastfeeding Friendly Mother designation in 2004 at my initiative and received that, and I believe are currently the only law firm on the list. But what strikes me about that is that there really is no reason why our firm is the only firm on the list or why other firms or other businesses could not be doing this as well. And I think though the DHS program is an outstanding program, I don't think it has been particularly effective at spreading the message and relies primarily currently on the advocacy of women to seek it out and perhaps suggest that their employers sign up for the program. It actually took me some effort to try to find it. Someone mentioned to me that the program existed, and I had to sort of Google it quite heavily before I finally was able to find it. It's not particularly easy to track down, even on the DHS website. So I think that this bill provides a much stronger avenue to educate businesses and doesn't rely simply on the advocacy efforts of women, some of whom may be quite able to suggest that their companies do that, and others of which may not be able to do so. The only other comment that I would make, based on some comments that were made earlier by the Bankers Association and Association of Oregon Industries, is on the change of the numbers at a location of having the bill or a different scheme be in place if there are only 15, for example, at a particular location. Two things about that strike me. The first one is that I think, as written, the undue hardship language is already structured to allow businesses at which there are a small number of employees at a particular location to take that into consideration as to whether or not they would even need to comply with the bill. And the second thing that struck me was thinking that that probably means that some huge employers, the Gap or Starbucks, may never have to comply with the bill, because I can't recall very many Starbucks where there are more than 15 employees in a particular location, and so that was something that just struck me. Really, I'm just here to answer any questions that you may have about the business side of the equation, and I welcome any questions. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any quick questions? Yes,
definitely. Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a quick question that this might be the best place to interject a thought that I've had. In the discussion of the undue hardship and the question that was raised about whether or not financial resources should be considered, I'm just wondering if in that sentence on line 9 the word "and" could be changed to "or," which would allow some flexibility in determining what might be considered an undue hardship. It would read then "size, financial resources, nature, or structure of an employee's business." And I was just curious if that would be a detriment to the bill, or if from a business perspective that might be helpful. to address some of the concerns we've heard.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and Representative Cowan. I am sensitive to businesses, of course, private businesses wanting to keep their books and finances private. That may make the bill more palatable, either putting it in as an or, as instead of a requirement, or perhaps eliminating it altogether. I do think that for businesses that don't otherwise have to make their records public, such as a public company, that is an issue of sensitivity.
Thank you. I threw the question out at this point as we're discussing some changes and to plant it in the minds of some folks who might consider that as we work through any necessary amendments in the bill.
Thank you, Representative. One of you ladies would like to continue.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Lori Mateer. I'm the Women's Health Division Director at OHSU and Dornbecker Children's Hospital. And for the record, I have lactated a total of 10 years for 6 children in 3 states and 3 employers, and would not wish the assertiveness required to make that happen on any woman. I'm also responsible for OHSU receiving the designation from the State Department of Health as a breastfeeding mother-friendly employer. And this project demonstrates what we administrators describe as a relatively low-yield, high-impact project, which, in other words, relatively minimal effort produces maximum return. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But as a result of this program, greater than 11,500 employees will benefit. And that number could probably be expanded because of the numerous phone calls and questions I've received from employees regarding their spouses employed in other businesses across the state of Oregon. I'd like to share a few key observations thus far of this program being implemented at OHSU. As stated in the literature, increased employee engagement and productivity occurs when breastfeeding support is implemented in the workplace. Within a matter of weeks, I personally received greater than 70 pages of emails of thank yous from employees in support and thanking that this actually occurred. And a predominant theme among the messages was that we considered a family-centered policy for employees. Now, in healthcare, we pride ourselves in providing family-centered care to patients, but the beauty of this initiative is that it extends this focus on the customer to the employee. And in healthcare, perhaps our view of employees is a little more sophisticated than in other business industries due to the gross national shortage of healthcare workers that we have. And I'll expound on that in a little bit as well. I'd like you to note that there are only 8 designated lactation rooms available for 11,500 employees. This policy was adopted mid-fiscal year, meaning that there was no budgeted monies allowed to create additional space for women to have a private room. Additionally, when you consider OHSU with satellite clinics all over the state and the space issues that occur on Markham Hill, you're lucky to even find a parking place on Markham Hill. But I'd like to share with you a few key examples of how 150 leaders actually began sitting down and talking about how they could support all of the employees in the work environment. One particular example on one of my departments, it's a postpartum unit with 32 beds and virtually no space that could be used, no private office space, to identify a place for women to pump. So what we did, managers that reported to me and staff members collaboratively identified a corner of the woman's locker room on another floor as a space that would be accessible. Another example, at the Primate Center off of Markham Hill, a woman and her manager called and said, there's absolutely no space anywhere that's available. So one of the managers offered the woman to utilize her office space, and she did not feel very comfortable because it was just in an area where there was a heavy flow of traffic. So the women located a large closet in the basement of the building and requested that she be able to use this.
to lactate. And the policy states that we will support all employees in this effort, and so the woman was supported to do that in the basement. Now, the reason that I bring this up is because this was initially not easy to pass. If any of you are familiar with the academic medical environment, there are 200 opinions for every decision. But the reason I bring this up is because the proverbial carrot that would entice a company to want to pursue this initiative was not realized until the initiative was in place. And Quint Studer, a great leader, points out that we should all companies should be careful to what he describes as use the term terminal uniqueness that would preclude them from offering any benefit to employees that would eventually return. And the data is clear and conclusive for employers. For every dollar invested in supporting breastfeeding, there is a $3 return. Okay. Women and their partners experience greater job satisfaction and an increased duration. Babies and moms are physically and emotionally healthier. There's been considerable discussion about the health to the babies, but it has not been well documented in these hearings, the benefits to the mother, which are an increased incidence of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, endometrial cancer. There's also an increased feeling of connectedness to their infants, which in some studies is associated with a reduction in child neglect and abuse. Employers receive less absenteeism, increased productivity, as I said, and increased employee engagement, and reduced employee turnover. It is win-win by all. Society at large benefits by the reduction of the $3.6 billion cost of not breastfeeding that is documented by the United States Department of Health and is a 2002 statistic, so with 5 years we could easily add 15% to 20%. All of these facts are based on scientific data and are easily quantifiable, but what I would like the committee to consider as well is a question that is not so easily quantified. And that question is, would there be a reduction if this bill were approved? What are the long-term health implications for the children of our employees? How many asthma diagnoses will not occur in the state of Oregon? How many infections will not be realized? And will a child's cancer diagnosis be stayed as a result of one company that thought it would be more difficult to do than to do actually implemented this and provided this opportunity for their employees? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions? Thank you.
Madam Tanay and members of the committee, I'm Amelia Pismay from Portland, Oregon. I serve as the Executive Director of Nursing Mothers Council of Oregon, and I support House Bill 2372. It's my task today to represent two of the employers who are supportive of the bill and provided testimony, but were not able to be here in person. One of the employers has provided six voices of testimony, so I'm going to just very quickly try to walk you through these as the representative today. The first bit of testimony comes from Claudia Konotek. She is the Community Relations Manager at New Seasons Market. New Seasons has 8 locally owned and operated neighborhood grocery stores in the Portland metropolitan area and employs over 1,500 employees. She writes, New Seasons Market is a longtime supporter of a woman's right to breastfeed a child. We passionately champion this cause in our workplace. New Seasons Market is very proud to be the first grocery store and the only chain to receive the DHS Breastfeeding Mother-Friendly Employer designation. To receive this recognition, New Seasons Market set up procedures and programs that allow nursing mothers who choose to return to work adequate time and a private place to express milk or nurse their baby and a refrigerated space to store breast milk. The steps we took to make these changes were inexpensive and did not impose a hardship on the company or on their fellow staff members. not only is providing accommodations for working mothers in our stores not a hardship, we find it has affected our business in a positive manner. This program has allowed some of our most valued staff to return to work sooner. These mothers are less likely to take time off of work to care for an ill child. A mother that feels good about continuing to offer her baby breast milk when she returns to work is more likely to provide our customers with excellent customer service. Those customers tell other customers about the way they have been treated, and our business thrives. And Ms. Konotek was kind enough to, on the back page of her testimony, provide the sample, a sample of her workplace policy that she has implemented. The second employer that I'm representing today is Hannah Anderson. And again, there's six different people who have sent in testimony. So I'll just walk you through that very quickly. First, from Gretchen Peterson, the Vice President of Human Resources, writes, "I urge you to support House Bill 2372. In general, this bill just makes sense for businesses. As a company with progressive associate relations and policies, we have supported our associates as they return to work, but providing a nursing mother's room in our building and allowing for additional rest periods as needed to express milk. This has not proven to be a burden in our company. In fact, we believe supporting these needs encourages our associates to return to work for us following their parental leave of absence. The longer-term breastfeeding of their infants provides greater protection for illnesses, thus resulting in lower absenteeism." And then goes on to describe critical staff members who are able to return to work. Gunn Denhart, the founder of Hannah Anderson Corporation, adds, "Breastfeeding support in the workplace is a true win-win-win for mothers, for babies, and for employers. Hannah Anderson has provided a space for nursing mothers for almost 10 years. We have found this to be a policy that our employees have valued highly, and that has not been a burden to the company." And then some of their employees were also moved to write in support. Jennifer Schurer, a merchandise manager for Hannah Anderson, writes, "At Hannah Anderson, I've been very fortunate to have access to a private room with seating, electricity, a sink, and refrigeration, accommodations necessary for the process of expressing milk. With these provisions, returning to work became an easier decision, and with the support of the company, to allow me the time to express, the duration for which I have had breast milk available was greatly increased." Shannon Litchfield, a senior merchandising manager, writes, "As a new mother with a full-time job, I urge you to support House Bill 2372. I feel very fortunate as I could not have continued to breastfeed my son without the accommodations Hannah Anderson provides its employees." And last, Diane Hogard, the girls designer at Hannah Anderson Corporation, writes, "I wanted to do the right thing for my child and me by nursing him his first year. I was so pleased to have a place to go other than the restroom, which would not have felt as clean as I would want for handling the milk my child is going to drink." So in my own words, I just wanted to very quickly point out two things. This last year, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention published a guide to breastfeeding interventions. This provides evidence-based work that communities can do to make an impact in breastfeeding rates and improve the health of our citizenry. And there is a section related to breastfeeding policies in the workplace, and an action step, recommended action step from CDC specifically states, promote legislation to support worksite lactation programs through mandates or incentives. And in fact, Oregon is noted on this page with the DHS employer packet, noted with the website and celebrated, you know, on a national level. So people are watching what's happening in Oregon. People are paying attention to this. And then finally, from work that I was privileged to do on the national level this year, I just wanted to make you aware that the HRSA, which is the Health Resources Services Administration, in June of this year, is making ready to publish a very comprehensive toolkit for employers. There's 5 different components to this toolkit, including information for the employer, for the employee, for the HR manager, for the community at large, and then even resources ready to print, to advertise the room, and things like this. So help is coming for employers to see exactly how to implement this in their work sites. This is recognized on a national level to make a critical difference, and employers will be helped from many directions to be able to do this. So thank you so much for the time to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions or refer them to the people I was representing today.
Thank you, Ms. Smythe. Any quick questions? Seeing none, thank you. Thank Wonderful you. Panel. So we have Marsha Oldheimer. Is that correct?
Paul Miller.
Oh, thank you. And Diane Garrett, why don't you come up, too?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm the legal policy advisor for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I realize that Boley has already testified in these hearings. I wasn't here for the previous session on this bill, but I was here today to listen and see if more technical information might be needed by the committee, and a number of questions have come up that I might be able to be helpful with. I'm happy to defer that testimony until the other witnesses have made their statements. I'm basically going to be referring back to things that people have talked about and questions that have come up to provide the information that I can from the Boley perspective. So would you want me to go ahead now?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Well, these are in sort of the order in which they came up from your other witnesses today. A question came up about structuring the use of the paid leave in the bill, and that's a good question because right now it's just recited in the bill that paid leave, if it was available to the employee, could be used for this purpose. Under OFLA, it spelled out the order in which paid leave would be used by employees. And if the committee wishes or if the legislature wishes, they might want to either spell it out that way or say they want it the same way as OFLA or defer it to rulemaking or whatever decision. But that's a good question. Does need to be addressed. A statement was made that perhaps Boley could mediate these cases rather than take them on as enforcement cases and have sort of a system where we take a complaint and maybe make a site visit and have a sort of a mediation system. First of all, we don't have a mediation unit at Boley. We do have mediation available in connection with contested cases where enforcement case has gone all the way through Wage and Hour, all the way through the Civil Rights Division, hasn't resolved, and charges are issued. Mediation is one opportunity for the agency and the respondent to work it out, and our administrative law judges are trained for that. We do not typically use mediation near the front door, although all of our investigators in both Wage and Hour and Civil Rights are trained to settle cases. They know how to do that. In fact, if we didn't settle a lot of cases, I don't know what we would do because we simply don't have the resources to take every single case all the way through the enforcement process. The concern I have about seeing this as a mediation question is it sounds like from the health department's perspective or the public health division that as a voluntary program, it's made some progress, but in fact is not taking off like wildfire in terms of everyone jumping on the bandwagon. So if the legislature chooses to take the approach of making this be a required thing, then what the enforcement process would be with our agency, and this would be in our Wage and Hour division because it's a rest and meal period provision, that a complaint would be made and it would be the investigator who got it or the intake person would make some phone calls to, first of all, you know, the employer does know when we've got a case going on. We have no incentive to hide the ball. Elicit information from their perspective. Is there a way to work this out short of going through the enforcement process? As it's been mentioned, this is a time-sensitive kind of a piece of legislation you're looking at here, so we can't take months and months to adjudicate what happens. We would need to step in very quickly and say, is there a misunderstanding here? In many cases, we find employers don't know the law, and when they are told the law or shown the law, they say, oh, that's what our technical assistance division is there for. They educate employers. They have seminars, and they have a hotline, and they do tons of education for Oregon employers all the time, just telling them what the laws are. That goes a long way toward compliance. If you didn't know what you were supposed to do and now you do. So we would make every effort, as it sounds like the previous Boley witness testified, not to turn these into a big enforcement case, but in fact to resolve them. The penalty is a civil penalty. It doesn't go into the pocket of the person whose rights are allegedly being violated. And so from our perspective, we don't have an incentive to collect civil penalties. They don't go to our agency anyway. They're routed somewhere else. So I just want to say in terms of the enforcement process that, you know, that's what I can tell you about how it works, you know, in sort of in real life within the agency. The question about whether the number of employees, the threshold number of employees, should be changed or should be modified for smaller employers, I would just point out that OFLA, which we also enforce, has 25 employees as the threshold number, and that is a statewide number. It's not per facility. So OFLA, of course, requires a lot more in the way of a right than this does in terms of 12 weeks of leave. And so the legislature has already made a policy choice about requiring OFLA.
Let me interrupt you just for a moment. Will you talk about what OFLA is for people who might not know what that is?
The Oregon Family Leave Act, which is the state family leave law as distinguished from FMLA, which is the Federal Family Leave Act. And the Oregon Family Leave Act requires of employees who have 25 or more employees to provide up to 12 weeks of family leave per year, which could be parental leave or it could be for a serious illness of their self or their family member. So that's what I'm talking about. Sorry for the acronyms I'm throwing around here. As far as the question of employers being reluctant to disclose financial resources to prove undue hardship, the term undue hardship already appears in Oregon's disability law, where it was kind of moved over from the federal administrative Americans with Disabilities Act. It refers to a situation where an employer under those laws is having problems reasonably accommodating someone into a job because of their disability, because it's a hardship on that particular employer. And without comparing the wording of this bill to the Oregon Disability Law or ADA, which I haven't had a chance to do, the terminology is quite similar. Undue hardship means significant difficulty or expense when considered in relation to the size, financial resources, nature, and structure of the employer's business. Those are pretty much word for word what we would look at in a disability case about whether a business could in fact provide a reasonable accommodation. We are used to looking at those kinds of questions. We look at them in other contexts already. As far as BOLI finding out a business's financial resources, not only under the undue hardship question for disability, but under all kinds of other enforcement questions, prevailing wage, whether an employer can pay wages simply under the minimum wage statute, and all other kinds of ways, we look at employers' financial resources all the time. And if an employer uses something like undue hardship as a defense, in fact, if they didn't show us some evidence, then we have nothing to go on except their allegation. And so, you know, they could choose not to use that for their defense. They could use something else. But we have lots of financial records of Oregon businesses, and we don't publish them in the Oregonian or throw them around lightly. We have public records exemptions that treat those kinds of things with respect. And so, you know, I just want to put that out there, that that wouldn't be a new and different thing either for businesses to have to do if they choose to use undue hardship as a defense. Okay, we already talked about OFLA. And a question came up whether restrooms might be okay under some circumstances, and I believe the wording of the bill says something like a reasonable effort to find an appropriate space and wouldn't completely ban the use of restrooms. It does, in fact, have specific language saying, the restrooms could be adjacent to the public restroom. I think what the bill is trying to avoid, and this isn't so much a bully point, but just something I've heard discussed about the bill, is there's no sort of ambiance in being in a public restroom sitting on a toilet seat trying to nurse a baby. So I think what we're talking about is the restroom may be clean, but we're talking about privacy, and we're talking about appropriate furniture, furnishings, or whatever. It doesn't have to be fancy, but it should be what would be considered an appropriate space for one of your family members or yourself if you were in that circumstance. So I don't think we're saying there's an absolute ban. From Bully's perspective, I guess we would have to look at this for enforcement. If it was in a restroom, is it necessarily not in compliance? And I would say no. We would look at the whole circumstance and whether that was a reasonable circumstance for that business. As far as enforcement going to the public health division, that's a question for the committee or the legislature. We already enforce rest and meal periods at BOLI, so we're familiar with that terrain. But on the other hand, this bill was not initiated by BOLI, And so, you know, where it goes for enforcement would be a question for the legislature. We've already talked about that. Oh, a comment was made that perhaps employees could work this out ahead with their employers, which is a great idea, I think, if you're already working there. If you're not, then, of course, that's not necessarily going to apply. So in some circumstances, employees would have that opportunity to do, but not always. The question from the Oregon School Boards is interesting, and it may, in fact, already at least in part have an answer. The way rest and meal periods work already, not this, but already rest and meal periods under the law, if there's a collective bargaining agreement that specifically speaks to rest and meal periods, then BOLI's rest and meal periods rules do not apply. And that's an administrative rule. It's not in the statute, so there's no way a lot of people would necessarily know about it, but I think people who deal in this area are aware of it. And so I'm just putting that out there for you to know. I don't know if that answers the whole question for the school boards, because as an example, under the Oregon Family Leave Act, there's a whole section of special rules for school teachers, because when family leave was being legislated at the federal and state level, they found there were certain there were just a lot of specific considerations for schools that did not exist for other employers. But in fact, if school employees are under a collective bargaining agreement and it specifically spoke to rest and meal periods, this might already be considered covered, which is another technical question that we can provide more information to the committee on. But like I said, our rules would provide that if rest periods are collectively bargained, that our rules don't apply. This bill would go under the statute that our other rest and meal periods are, well, under the set of statutes that the authority for our rest and meal periods rules come from. So if it went the same way as rest and meal periods, if it was specifically bargained, then our rules would not apply, and perhaps this legislation would not apply. I hope I didn't just confuse you more, but I was sitting there listening to all these discussions of all these things, and I hoped that I could illuminate them to some extent. And as I said, we can submit written testimony or answers to written questions or whatever would be helpful in a technical sense for you to iron out some of these things.
Thank you.
Colleagues, our time is running out, and we had two other items on today's agenda, and I think what I'm going to do is ask those folks if they wouldn't mind coming back again. Obviously, this is going to be taking more time, and I apologize for people who came for those other two items, House Bill 2181 and the informational hearing regarding data collection. So thank you for coming, but I think we're going to take the rest of the time for this bill. Pardon?
I'm sure I've got other appointments.
I know. So we're not going to be hearing those. So we're going to finish up here because our time goes until 10:30. It goes from 8:30 to 10:30.
I'm sorry, ma'am. Madam Chair, I thought it was 8 to 10, and then we elected to go to 8:30.
8:30 to 10:30. But if you've – that's my intent, is to go until 10:30.
Okay.
So – we'll hear from these folks, and we're going to excuse the rest of the folks. So any questions for Mrs. Oldmiller?
I have a question.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. If the penalties would be routed to some other area anyway, I'm wondering, can you imagine any objection from your agency to, for instance, dedicating all potential penalties under this law, if it becomes law, to, for instance, the breastfeeding mother friend employer project, as an example of where fines might be routed?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, that's not our call. That's a legislative call. All the civil penalties that come through BOLI are designated by the legislature to go to particular places. I would say that this bill does say that to the extent that the agency has incurred expenses for enforcement, that those would go to BOLI. And the way we track this for other cases is literally hour by hour, task by task, and then we, that money comes into the budget. There are very few areas where we're allowed to do that. But I will say that, you know, for purposes of our own resources, where we're taking on new tasks or new assignments like this, that we would certainly hope that we could get, you know, the reimbursed for the enforcement piece itself. But as far as where the rest of it goes, that's the legislative call.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Marcia, two really quick questions. One is deals with does BOLI have a policy that dictates how many violations that they would receive from an employer in a situation like this before they act then for enforcement?
No, we don't. A first offense, you know, if it's not resolved and the employer appears to be in violation, we would go forward with that. What you might be thinking of is sometimes when there's repeated adjudicated violations or violations that are pled to in a settlement with the agency, then those can be used as what's called aggravating factors in future cases. I don't think that comes up so much in rest and meal period violations as it does in farm and forest labor contracting and some things like that.
Okay, additional question. Okay. Section 2, which is the penalty section, it talks about the civil penalty not to exceed $1,000 against any person who willfully violates. I actually have two questions off that. One is the $1,000. Is that a one-time set penalty that's applied, or is that on a daily type event? Or, you know, just could you explain that to me?
Well, the civil penalty under, I wish Christine Hammond were here from Wages and Hour to talk about this more specifically, because I'm not in that division. So first of all, it doesn't have to be $1,000. It could be less, and
sure,
there's the discretion with the division to determine that. If there were more than one violation going on, say more than one person in the same employment place complained at the same time, that could be two violations. As to whether each day they didn't provide the rest and meal periods, under the rest and meal period rules, technically there could be a new penalty for every time the person didn't get their rest or meal period. I don't think that typically we do that, although there have been egregious cases where they have ended up doing that. But I can't speak specifically to whether we would do it under here. Christine Hammond would be a better person to answer that for you.
And then the follow-up, same section there. I'm just curious your thoughts on the portion there following that where it says $1,000 against any person who willfully violates. I'm curious your thoughts of what willfully.
Well, there's a lot of law on willfully, Representative Olson, and in fact, I could, you know, BOLI could provide to the committee what willfully means, but it is a term that, in essence, it is, if you do, it's pretty close to strict liability. If you did it, and it was probably willful, and there's case law on it and everything, so I don't really want to go into too many details, but there is a test.
It's 104 of culpable mental state.
One short question. So what you're saying, wage and rest period, that if it's part of a collective bargaining agreement, that actually during that collective bargaining process, you could bargain away that right?
That is true. Under the current rest and meal period statutes and rules, if it's specifically spoken to in the collective bargaining agreement, and we need to look at that when we see one of those cases, not just a mere reference to it, but specifically this is what's being decided, then the rule says that it doesn't, our rest and meal period requirements do not apply.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to follow up on that point because that actually speaks to the concern that I had after OSBA raised this. So if it became a mandatory subject of bargaining, an unintended consequence if we did not fix that could be that school teachers and school employees might not end up being protected by this statute. We might unintentionally exempt them from the protections of being able to have rest periods to express milk and appropriate places to do that if that was traded off in a collective bargaining agreement.
That is true, and that's kind of an overwhelming statement, but I mean, in general, what you're saying is true. If it was in a collective bargaining agreement that there should be no rest and meal periods, and that both sides signed off on that, which would be rare. We haven't seen it yet. Then rest and meal periods would not apply. If the legislature wishes this provision to not be treated like that, since the current rule is a rule, then they could trump that by saying, in this case, it can't be bargained away, even if it's specifically referenced in a collective bargaining agreement.
Can I follow up? So, in your experience, because you understand how these things actually work much better than I do, what is the best avenue for ensuring that this population of employees, who is very likely to have these needs given that workforce, what is the most likely and effective way to put teeth into this type of a requirement to ensure that those women in that profession have access to what it is that we're trying to do here?
Representative Gelsey, I wonder if perhaps we couldn't invite her to be on the work group so you can hash those things out.
Mm-hmm.
Does that work?
That would work. Thank you.
Okay, so that gives you some time to think about that.
Thank you.
Any other quick questions? All right. Diane?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what a lively discussion we've had this morning, and I am so pleased. I feel that we do not have far to go in reaching an agreement on what this bill can contain. I think I feel very positive about the interaction we've had today. In the spirit of moving towards agreement, I would just like to go through the bill on the areas that have been raised, kind of give you some sense of what movement the proponents can give to the bill. But I do want to make it very clear that entertaining changes to this bill, from my perspective, can only be if we are moving towards agreement. There are many changes that were made to this bill last session at the behest of making it better and more palatable, and it did not go well. So, I would need assurance that people were at the table in sincerity, that they would support the bill as these changes were made. I just want to be very, very straightforward with you about that, that proponents need that assurance, that we're not just running after a moving target. I would just cite a couple of examples. The size of firm was raised last time, very specifically at request of AOI. The employee notification was added. The very specific language about the time was added. A room connected to a public restroom, such as a lounge, was added. We are acting in good faith with the business community, and we are interested in making this work for everybody. But it has to work for everybody, and that includes the babies. So, line 6 and 7, 8 and 9, page 1, regarding reasonable efforts and undue hardship, this subjective language. Legislative counsel indicated that language needs to be there. It creates a framework for the conversation. As far as the financial resources aspect, the proponents do not have a problem removing that from the bill if it will help us reach agreement. I would just say in the defense of the business community, if they don't want that as a defense, that does not make sense to me. I would think I would want that as a defense. But if they are saying they don't, we don't have a problem with removing that. As far as the expedited mediation through BOLI and penalty, I think we've already covered how that would put a mom's milk supply in jeopardy if we did not have a response time of 48 hours. I mean, we're talking a very fast response time in a very difficult situation that's very stressful. So obviously, we're not opposed to some sort of mediation. From what I am hearing from BOLI, part of their enforcement process is mediation, so that there are many steps along the way. They don't just come in and slap down a $1,000 fine and, you know, shame on you, that there is some sort of process. If language can be improved around the enforcement, again, aiming towards agreement, we are obviously open to that. We are not interested in a hammer for its own sake. I would like to address the collective bargaining issue. From my point of view, which is limited, obviously, you know, I am not on collective bargaining committees or anything like that. My only concern would be that if we put specific language about collective bargaining for school boards, then what about all of the other unions that do collective bargaining? How are we going to account for the electricians and the construction trades and, you know, all the other people? Then, you know, we have to account for that. From my point of view, I would tend to want it part of a collective bargaining agreement alongside all of your other health benefits, because this is a health benefit. Access to breastfeeding a baby is providing a health benefit. So I see it through that lens. But obviously, more conversation can be had, I think, around how to appropriately speak to this in the bill. But the spirit of the proponents is access. We need moms to have access to this, and however we need to protect that access is what we want to go after. So I'm not, you know, going to draw the line in the sand and say, you know, no, nothing. But in the spirit of reaching agreement, I would just repeat that. The changing the size of firm to being specific to a location, you will not see much movement on that one from the proponents, simply because that's going to blow a hole through this bill big enough to drive a truck through. It's just, I don't even know if we can track, you know, by location. You know, how are we going to track that? How are we going to enforce that? Basically, we're talking about, you know, in the bank teller situation, instead of covering that woman's break for 10 minutes, you're going to cover it for 20 more minutes. So they already are working out coverage issues. It's just we're asking for an extra 20 minutes on top of it. So at worst, you're talking about somebody else delaying their 10-minute break by 20 minutes. So I hear that they feel concerned about that, and yet they're also able to work it out. I heard that they are working it out. It's possible. So those are just some of the things that came to mind as I listened today. And I would also like to refer you to my testimony last week with all of those charts and graphs, that once again, to remind you, this would apply to 10% of Oregon businesses, 90% would be exempt. And where that lines up with counties and births, there's 5 counties that carry about 50% of the size of firm here, and the same 5 counties carry, you know, over 50% of the births. It's Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, Marion, and Lane. Those are the 5 counties that would most benefit from this bill and would also be carrying the responsibility, you know, by and large. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I feel we are moving forward and that we're going to reach an agreement.
Thank you, Ms. Garrett. Ms. Olson.
Thanks, Diane. I'm just curious, the worksite concept. What do you do with the bank that only has 5 employees? I mean, but it's a branch.
It's my understanding they're already having to cover break time. They already are having to make coverage. We're just asking for 20 more minutes of coverage. If for some reason that presents an undue hardship on the business, they can be exempted from this. And I'm not hearing that there would be opposition from the business community to appeal to the undue hardship, particularly if we remove the financial resources piece. So I feel like we've accounted for situations where it isn't workable. Did that kind of...
I would absolutely love to take you to the bank in Jefferson that has 5 employees and no rooms hardly available or anything, so you could have that picture and see what's going on there. And that's not just a normal, I mean, a unique spot. I'm sure plenty of organs like that.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson,
I guess I would just observe on the big picture that that is not the fault of the breastfeeding moms and babies, that that is the responsibility of the whole culture to correct this egregious omission that we do not account for moms' breastfeeding needs in the workplace. And whether it's 5 people in Jefferson or it's 11,000 people at OHSU, we have to face this, and we have to start taking steps to address it, or our duration rates aren't going to go up. They're going to go down, and they do go down in economic downturns. We saw that in 2003. Our rates in Oregon were going like this, and then they went down 3% at 6 months. And it's sure it's because moms had to go back to work. So I feel, obviously, I'm warming to my topic.
Thank you, Ms. Garrett. Representative Mauer.
Thank you. Diane, about the point of the workplace, you know, cultural change in a lot of cases is made through statute, and statute is corrected in courtrooms. And so you could say a workplace of 5, that bully says, yes, that's unreasonable. Then that works opposite. So then the entire company, it's unreasonable. So I think there may be the argument of breaking into smaller pieces may work against where you're trying to go. That, in fact, it rolls uphill instead of rolling downhill, as I think the business community. And when we, I don't want to try to parse that out, but that's just a comment. The other thing is that in earlier testimony, you said that this is model legislation for the rest of the country. Is that accurate? Or at least we're trying to get there.
By far, this would be the most detailed legislation. People in other states are not discussing the time and location components to the degree that we are in this state. The language reasonable efforts and undue hardship is given very generally. That's it. I mean, it's very short. And in my packet of testimony from last week, I give you the specific language from all those other states. So, you know, I feel that, you know, this would be a very positive step forward for the country to see how Oregon is working it out.
One last follow-up. And in, with that point, it's imperative that we get it right. And so I encourage your participation in this movement, because I think there is clearly it's going to happen. But so I encourage your participation in the minutia of the details and the implications of what we say.
Representative Kotek and then Representative Gelfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding, there's nothing in the bill that for employers 25 or above could claim undue hardship for a work site. Would it be helpful to clarify that? Because as opposed to changing the number, I mean, the way I read this is if you're an employer, a large employer, you're subject to this, but you could exempt certain site locations based on undue hardship. Is that correct? Would it be helpful to clarify that? I don't know.
Well, then we're looking at needing to confer with Boley as far as what language they need for the enforcement mechanism.
Okay.
Representative Gelfer.
Great, thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to small branch locations like the Jefferson branch, wouldn't that be covered in the undue hardship, because it includes not just the size and financial resources of the business altogether, but also the structure? So might not that account for a 5-member branch and not put unreasonable hardship on those small banks?
Madam Chair and Representative Gelzer, that is my understanding, that, you know, when we talk about size, nature, and structure of a business, that is what we're intending to get at here. And I, you know, I'm not sure if we need to put in, you know, number of employees at a specific location. I don't know if we need to get that specific, or if this language creates a framework within which that can be adequately addressed. I mean, obviously, we're trying to strike the balance between too general and too specific. You know, we're trying to find that, you know, what's clear enough so that we all feel like we've got a sense of what this looks like and we can move ahead with this, but that we're not hampering ourselves with too much minutia.
Thank you, Diane. We're going to be moving on to our last witness. Thank you so much for waiting.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Goodmojab. I was here at the last hearing, and my colleague Diane asked me to return this time in case there were any specific questions that came up, given my background as a researcher and International Board Certified Lactation Consultant and educator and such. I wanted to also say a couple of details that hadn't really been mentioned very fully in the previous week's hearing. I think the reason behind the desire to have this bill and this legislation is because biology has a mandate. When we introduce formula into the infant gut, when we introduce anything other than human milk into the infant gut, we are creating a situation that biology determines the result, not our culture, not our wishes, not our desire. It's just how it is. The milk of each mammalian species is unique to that species. And you can't transfer one milk from one species to another without very measurable, significant results. Human milk has over 200 components, some of which we don't even know what they do yet. We're still trying to figure out how does this work and where do these multiple risks of formula feeding come from? You know, what is it? We know that human milk, it has inherent components. Formula does not. It doesn't contain the ingredients that are inherent in human milk. And it contains, it's missing things, and it has things that the infant gut biologically should not be receiving. So this can, when we even introduce just one feeding, could be a 2-ounce, one-time 2-ounce feeding of formula to the infant gut. And you can imagine a mom who's not getting support in the workplace, she can't pump. What's she going to feed to her baby, right? Even, and will she have milk when she goes home to feed her baby, right? So we're talking about just one time, much less all of these other countless times that can happen when we don't have adequate workplace support. But one feeding can alter the infant gut for up to 4 weeks. We're talking about changes in the bacterial flora, where we go from, you've probably all heard of, you know, eat your yogurt, you've got to have your acidophilus, you've got to have, you know, healthy bacteria, probiotics, that kind of thing. That's what's in the gut of the breastfed baby. As soon as we introduce something else, we shift the pH of the gut and the bacterial flora into what's called putrefactive state. This is nasty. This is disease-causing microbes. And this is partly where the decline in health comes from. Another thing that a lot of people don't know, and our first witness here in this group stated that many employers don't know the law, and the first thing I thought of is many employers don't know this. They don't know why they should be doing this. They don't know why they should be getting voluntary recognition, you know, recognition for voluntary compliance with the state's breastfeeding program, and they certainly, they don't know the law either, which we don't have yet in a strong enough way. But one detail is that during the first 6 months of life, the infant gut is permeable. There are these gaps between the cells. Over time, during that 6 months, gradually that permeability decreases and the gut functions in a dramatically different way. The reason it's permeable is it helps, it lets some of these large cells that are unique to human milk pass directly into the bloodstream. If you look in the one-page additional testimony that I provided today, you can see the picture. You've got these big blobs of things in the human milk that do not exist in the infant formula. So this is a desirable state for the infant gut. It's not a problem, and these things pass through. The problem is that cow's milk proteins are also large. Soybean protein is also large, and they are able to pass directly through this permeable gut. They don't in the same way at the six-month mark, but during this first 6 months. That's where we get this exclusive breastfeeding. So when women run into these barriers in the workplace that either keep them providing exclusive breast milk to their babies or stop them completely, we are just altering the infant gut, increasing the risk of a variety of diseases. I sent some additional information by email to you, Representative Maurer, and you, Madam Chair, on the obesity issue. The list goes on and on. I have, you know, a dozen books this thick on my shelf about the research of why this matters, but the employers don't know it. And sometimes even the moms don't know it, so they don't have enough to back up their, you know, how assertive can they be in the workplace. So biology is giving us a mandate, and we need that mandate reflected in our legislation, and we made a good start last year, and there's been a lot of effort and a lot of progress, and I appreciate certainly all of the concerns coming together and people trying to move forward on this. So that if there were any additional technical questions, that was the primary reason for me to come today. I appreciate the opportunity to be here again, and
I'll take any other questions.
Thank you so much. You provide a lot of information for us that's helpful. Thank you. Thank you very much as a panel.
Thank you.
Of course, there's going to be more work on this. We're going to assign a work group to work with several people, and I'd like you to stay afterwards and talk with me for a minute about that, if you can take 2 minutes. Oh, I see that look on her face. Sorry, Representative Maurer, that I was not clear that our meetings go until 12:30. We can talk about that further. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2372 and close the meeting on the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness.